This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 1035.
Welcome to it. It's Thursday evening. Slightly warmer week here in the capital, and hopefully wherever you were, the weather was what you wanted it to be. Welcome to the Business Report, where we take a look at what's going on in the country and perhaps bring you some detail, some insight, and some personalities that perhaps you wouldn't normally have access to. So let's think about what's coming up in this evening and the lead story. We're going to take a look at, there's a lot of legislation at the moment hanging. We heard this week that FEMA has been delayed for further consultation, which seems on the surface to be the rational thing, but it made us think, well, what else hasn't come to bear that we've been discussing? And it turns out there's a lot more than you might think about. We'll talk to Frederica Links from the IPPR on the update of where we are on our regulatory progress, as it were. In the spotlight this evening, Dr. Esther Carley joins us from Letsego Bank, sharing her story. Stuart Lohman from BizNews, a wrap of all things down south, and some fascinating insights into what's happening there with the city of Cape Town looking to buy electricity from small-scale producers. And then petrol and fuel and diesel. We've all seen the big impacts in our wallets over the last few months, and there was threats of a strike from retailers. We'll talk to Henny Kruger and Maggie Shino, who's the Petroleum Commissioner of the country. Henny Kruger representing retailers, and we'll hear perhaps both sides of a very complex situation. And then also we'll be talking about some progress made in processing online visa applications. That is Taza, and Natalie Arons will bring us up to speed on that. So lots coming up in this evening's show. However, let's start things out with the Business Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews, I'm David Bishop. Minister of Labour, Industrial Relations and Employment Creation, Utoni Nyoma, has raised a concern regarding a continuous contravention of the relevant provisions of the Labour Act 2007 and the Collective Agreement for Minimum Wages in the security industry, after 61 of the 182 employers inspected were found to be non-compliant. Already heavily indebted South African power utility Eskom may need to borrow an extra 45 billion rand to purchase diesel and pay inflation-beating salaries to workers, says S&P Global Ratings, 50% more than the ratings agency's November borrowing forecast. National Union of Mine Workers of South Africa Secretary General Irving Jim says that members are dead set on a double-digit increase in its wage negotiations with the automotive sector of anywhere between 10 and 20% and are willing to strike in order to achieve it. Jim said workers were also interested in ensuring career progression for themselves and established career paths to the management level, adding that Labour's cooperation in the negotiations will depend entirely on the employer's openness and willingness to engage workers and their demands. And the euro fell below the symbolic level of $1 for the first time since December 2002 on Wednesday, weighed down by the darkening economic outlook for the single currency area and a possibility of a complete stoppage in Russian gas supplies, along with an increase in borrowing costs on the other side of the Atlantic, making the US dollar more attractive to investors. I'm David Bishop. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Welcome back. Time now for our lead story this evening. And our lead story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. Now, we thought, because of a number of stories that we were following up on and having a look at, that it would be useful to just get a sense of how much legislation was hanging at the moment. And this was largely off the back of the announcement that FEMA was postponed, and there'd been a lot of controversy around FEMA. So, with a lot of those sorts of things happening, we thought, let's do a bit of a roundup. And we could think of no one better to speak to than Frederica Links from the Institute for Public and Policy Research to bring us up to speed. These are the chaps who keep a hawk's eye on all the policy areas. Frederica, welcome to the show this evening.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Now, Just give us a bit of an oversight of what are some of the main pieces. I mentioned FEMA, but what are some of the main pieces of legislation that are currently in bill stage that we feel either will form an important or have the potential to disrupt things going forward?
I think the most important one that's currently hanging there isn't clear where it's going is the access to information bill. I mean, it's been passed, but it has to be signed by the president. So, you know, there's still that. And then I think another important law that was passed just at the end of last month, at the end of June, was the Public Procurement Amendment Act, I think, which will have a significant impact on government procurement. And, you know, given that government is the largest player in the local economy when it comes to sourcing and purchasing and so forth. So, I mean, this should have an important impact. Yeah, so, I mean, some new procurement methods have been introduced. And then the integrity, some of the integrity measures, the anti-corruption measures in the old law have been strengthened quite a bit, speaking to things like conflict of interest and disclosure of interest and so on. And then, you know, there are some other loopholes that have also been closed. It also addresses the issues around preferences, which have been problematic in the old law, in the implementation of the old law. So there are various issues there that, and actually we will be bringing out a analysis paper on this over the next few weeks. It's already done, but we'll just publishing it at the moment. We'll be bringing it out still in July, looking at some of these areas in the amendment in the new law that speak to strengthening a lot of these issues.
I mentioned FEMA in our preamble. Just give us a sense of why you feel the minister and AMFISA have once again postponed the implementation date.
Well, I mean, it's clear that, you know, the controversy around this revolves around the lack of consultation. And just from, you know, what we've been hearing from the financial sector, it's clear that this FEMA, the regulations they're trying to introduce, really suffer from a lack of consultation. So they have to go back to the drawing board. And this is another example of what we are continuously sort of try and spotlight is, you know, this bad law and policy and regulatory crafting, which involves government officials coming up with regulations in their offices and then, you know, not consulting properly. And this is exactly another example of this, what happened around FEMA. So hopefully they'll go back, do the proper consultations that they should have done in the first place and come back with regulations that speak to our realities and speak to, you know, where the industry and the public would like this to be.
Frederico, another bill that was circulated and has the potential to either seriously disrupt or seriously transform the Namibian economy was NEEF, the Namibian version of South Africa's broad-based economic empowerment. What is happening with NEEF at the moment? It seems to be raised almost sometimes as a threat from government when they're feeling like they need to get business to back down on one or two issues. That's certainly been the impression I've received from a couple of people. Where are we with NEEF?
Well, that's an open question. There were consultations by the Namibian Investment Promotion and Development Board, you know, sort of, I think early last year or maybe late 2020. I think it was early last year. And actually, we were involved in those consultations. The IPPR executive director, Graham Hopwood, was. But it's unclear what recommendations they came up with because we haven't seen a report on these consultations. So, you know, this thing just keeps dragging on and on. They by now should have been a report about the way forward? I mean, we've heard sort of about, you know, the 25% mandatory stake going to previously disadvantaged. We've heard that has been scrapped. But, you know, there are some other problematic areas in the NEEF draft that need to be addressed. And it's unclear where this is going and what's happening. So, you know, there doesn't appear to be a timeline on this. But it seems to be one of those things where, as you know, I think as you correctly pointed out there, that from time to time, the threat, it's being brandished as a threat or online or you know, and people keep on talking and calling for this. But, you know, it's one of those things you just feel where we're going to be surprised with a draft at some stage that, you know, will cause, I think, an uproar that, you know, that won't satisfy anybody. And you just, you know, you just feel that maybe this is another one where we'll all be saying afterwards, why didn't they consult properly? Why, you know, why did they bring this now at this stage? So, I mean, this is something that we need to keep an eye on. And I think that business really needs to pressure government on playing open cards with at this point in time.
Okay, NEEF. So we don't know where that's at, and we're expecting something to pop out. Let's look at one or two others that have been lying around. The Combating of Domestic Violence Amendment Bill. The government's talking about GBV. There seems to be a, you know, it's a trendy thing for politicians to be supporting. And of course, it's critical to the balancing of a healthy society. So what's happening with this amendment bill?
Well, I mean, that seems to be coming to a head finally. I mean, this has also been on floating around in parliament for a while now. Basically what this bill does, it strengthens a lot of the fines, the criminal fines and you know, sentences for rape as a way to deter, you know, sort of offenders. It introduces new sort of categories of vulnerable people, such as people with disabilities, are explicitly, you know, the sexual exploitation of people with disabilities, the rape of people with disabilities are now sort of being catered for appropriately in this bill. It speaks to, you know, rape as, it creates a new category where, or sort of expands the understanding of rape under, you know, under coercive circumstances. For instance, in employment situations where, you know, women are coerced into having sex against their will, by a senior or a supervisor. So, I mean, these sorts of areas are expanded on, but it mostly increases the fines or the prison terms. Let me not talk about fines, prison terms, as the penalties for rape.
Okay. When do we expect this to come in, Frederica?
Well, I mean, I think this is on the cusp of being passed right now and enacted, if I'm
all
speaking
right.
Under correction.
Moving on, the cybercrime bill. This is obviously something that's way overdue, given how rapidly this space is evolving and just how the numbers keep stacking up internationally for cybercrime. When do we expect this in, and are we in an advanced stage with the cybercrime bill?
Well, I mean, there is a bill that's a 2020 bill. I mean, but this has been coming on since, you know, almost 12, 13 years now. And I mean, I've been asking for the last 3 years about the status every year, you know, sort of at the beginning of the year, February, March, asking about the status of the bill. And the last I heard earlier this year was this parliamentary year or government financial year, which ends end of March next year, at some point during this financial year, a bill will be ready for tabling. But they've been saying that for 3 years now. So,
okay.
You know, it's something that
I'm sensing somewhat of a trend here, Frederica.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's the problem. I mean, the executive, you know, we always tend to look at Parliament and say, you know, they're not doing enough. They're not value for money when it comes to what they're supposed to be doing, passing legislation in the public interest. But they can't pass legislation if the executive doesn't bring bills to Parliament. And that's a big problem.
Okay. We're just about out of time. So thank you so much for taking us through what looks like nothing's really moving. There are a couple who've been published. We also expect new bills on green hydrogen. That has to be pretty much fast-tracked through the system. We've been speaking to James Miopi about that, and he's confident he can get it done quickly, but it doesn't seem like there's a good track record of that. And, of course, another area that we're looking at public policy on and not seeing any sort of cohesive framework on is cyber currencies, so cryptocurrencies. Just very, very briefly, any thoughts on that? Are we making any progress in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's we've been hearing, we've heard that before, where we heard, you know, we're going to move faster on certain things. But, you know, when it comes to very technical fields or sectors such as green hydrogen and so on, unfortunately, you know, we don't have the legal sectoral expertise in this country that would be able to come up with a proper law to speak to, you know, what we want, where we are now and where we want to be in the future, sort of flexible and smart a law that speaks to that. And we tend to then go out of the country, such as with the cybercrime and data protection bills as well, where we had European consultants come in, assistance from the Council of Europe and the Commonwealth to come up with the bills, these initial bills we have. And I think this is what's going to happen with a law on green hydrogen as well, where we have to go and get consultants and assistance from European governments and to help us write a law that we can speak to, that speaks to our realities. But that takes time.
All right.
So that we're back to that situation, you know.
We're going to have to leave it there, Federico. We're out of time. Thank you so much. Been great talking to you. That's Federico Links from the Institute for Public Policy Research. Just taking a bit of a scan on some of the things that are hanging with things we didn't get to. The Lotteries Act, which recently came into play, which is causing havoc in the retail sector. It seems that there is definite work to be done by the executive in getting better at getting laws that can be passed and then can actually achieve what they are set out to do. That's our lead story this evening, and our lead story proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Welcome back to the Business Report. I'm Gary Strubel, and you're on Nova 1035. Time now for our spotlight feature, where we are able to highlight the dreams, exploits, the successes, and visions of Namibians who are making a difference. And in this evening's spotlight, Dr. Esther Kali, the CEO of Letsego Namibia. She's been CEO for 5 years already. Some of the accomplishments, being able to successfully lead a team in order to obtain a banking license, which listed Letsego Namibia Holdings on the Namibia Stock Exchange in 2017, launching the bank's first products in 2018, becoming president of the Bankers Association of Namibia in 2020 and 2021, stepping into the shoes of Sorrel Fonsaile. So those are some big accomplishments. And from what I understand, Dr. Kali is only getting going. Dr. Esther Kali, welcome to the Business Report.
Thank you so much, and greetings to all the listeners out there.
Let's start at the beginning. Every story has a start, and as does yours, I'm sure. Tell us a little bit about whereabouts in the country do you come from, and perhaps one or two of the memories, your favorite memories as a child.
So I can say I call myself a Mondesa girl from Swakopmund. Firstly, I'm a mother to 3 beautiful children and the first lady to my better half. I was raised by a domestic worker who happened to be a single mom in the heart of Mondesa, as I alluded to earlier. I'm a sister to 5 amazing siblings, and I'm all a proud woman of substance, I can say. In my professional life, I'm a CEO, as you rightly say, of Letsego Namibia, an entity to watch out for because we are going big. I'm very passionate about my job and what is, and that is improving lives of others. What I love about my job is the purpose we stand for, improving lives. And remembering being a childhood, it was not an easy road for me to take up. And that's why my motto is really aligned to that one of Letsego, and that is improving lives. Really, in a nutshell, that is Esther Kali.
Dr. Kali, coming from humble background with a big family, access to education perhaps not quite as straightforward as it could be or should be. Tell us a little bit about how you picked your path. How did you get from what would have been trying circumstances into a corporate environment? Tell us a little bit about your education path.
So I remember, as I said, being raised by a single mom, it has not been easy. Money was not always available. So going to school, we need to go by feet. And whenever I tell my kids about that, they say, but why should you have gone by feet? Are you telling me you were that poor? So it's just the fact that kids today are not appreciating. I can tell you, I remember studying, we have to share a candle by as being a sibling of an elder of 5 siblings. We have to share a candle. So I remember also ending up doing domestic worker because I needed to assist my mom and I needed to pay for my school fee. So it was not all easy, but I can tell you that through that, there have been a lot of learnings. And today, here we are. Today, I can say I'm a proud CEO, and I can only give thanks to my mom who have been able to raise me from a mere salary of a domestic worker. While it has not been easy, it has also been a learning where we have been taught by our mom that no matter the circumstances, raise up, shine, and work hard, and you will make it. And today, I can proudly say it's because of my mom that I'm here where I am today.
What serves as a barrier for many young people, especially straight after school, is getting access to tertiary education. I can imagine it would have been impossible for your mom to pay for university. So perhaps just as serving as inspiration for other younger people, how were you able to access tertiary education?
So what then happened, I remember through my standard 10, which they call now standard 8, which they call now grade 10, I always wanted to be a banker. So, but then what had happened, for some reason, because I remember narrating the story to my teacher that I would want to become a banker. And my teacher told me, no, I think you are too stupid to work for the bank. But be it as it may, for a moment, I sort of almost give up on my dream. But then I wanted to go and study. But as I wanted to go and study, as I rightly said, there were no money. I ended up going to the north. And while I was in the north, I used to work for my uncle in a shop, and I was earning a mere $40. That is, we are talking now about the 80s, $40. So, but while I was working in the supermarket, I was also looking out for a job. And I got to hear that at the time FNB was looking for people to appoint. So I went there, I got my intake as a clerk, and I started to work then as an inquiry official. By working as an inquiry official, I talked to myself that I needed to upgrade myself. As much as I wanted to go to university and there was no money, I think I could make use of the opportunity. At the time, then we were able to get through the bank, they were able to give us study loans. And that's really how I sort of improved in my tertiary education, where I started off as a certificate in banking, moving to a bachelor degree in banking. And later I got my master's degree. So I really through while I was working, I also sort of improved my tertiary education through the study loans that I was able to get through the bank.
Dr. Gali, we are able to, by the magic of science, understand people's brains so much better if we ask them to pick a song. You apparently went and asked your daughter for recommendations, which tells me you're not listening to a lot of your own music, but tell us about the song that you've selected.
So I don't know why my daughter loved this song. I would have loved the song to say, go high, high, but this song, go low, low, and I love the song because when I dance with her, we sort of go low, low. In Afrikaans, they call it sack, sack, sack. So that's the song I want to pick up. I think it's by Booga. If you can play that song, I'll be happy.
Hey, grandma, don't sleep, wake up.
Booga, call out your money. You supposed to be jai jai. Kilo come, you come best thing. My dog best thing with a man. But when I land softly on the sofa floor. So far so good. Konnichiwa Joe.
That's a song called Booga here on the Business Report. Let me see you go low, low, low. And that is the choice this evening of Dr. Esther Kali, actually more the choice of her daughter, which she delegated. No, that's the art of a good leadership is good delegation. Dr. Kali, let's flick a little bit forward now to where you stand. 5 years as CEO of Letsego Bank. And it's fair to say there could have been an easier 5 years in the history of Namibia than the last five. But where are you satisfied with the progress that you've made over the last 5 years?
So far, I can say I'm happy with the results, but no one can never be satisfied because not even the sky can be the limit. I can tell you we have ambitions. We have visions for ourselves that we have set for ourselves. From when I introduce myself, I say Letsego is a place to watch for because we are going big. We are building, we are improving, and we are growing many initiatives on the horizon, many solutions that we want to bring to our customer. So I think what I can say is that the customer can watch the space. Maybe what I can talk to now is a solution we want to recently introduce, and it's called affordable housing, so that we can help our customer to also have a dignified homes. And we have been working around the clock to bring these solutions on board, so the customer can just watch the space for that when we are going to launch it.
Now, it's a very competitive space, banking. Largely, we now operate in global economies. Economies of scale and access to capital are two big, huge issues in running an effective banking service. How hard is it to run a niche, effectively what is a niche bank or started out as a niche bank, going up against continental banks like RMB and perhaps Standard Bank and Nedbank as well? How difficult is it to really be able to compete with some of these banks that are present in many countries?
So the competitive space had not been an easy one, but I can tell you that there is room for all banks currently in Namibia. We have a solution to, we have a problem to solve to our community, to our nation out there. And I think one that can win is the one who know what they stand for. I believe everyone have their niche market. I believe everyone have their strategy. I believe everyone have their vision. Currently, as we speak, Letsego stand for improving lives. Letsego know where they want to play. And Letsego also know what they want to become. So all those, we have what we call a strategy in one document. We have it out there. For us, it's really to serve our low to middle income and the micro small enterprises in order to improve lives. So we can stay true to what we stand for. I believe we can win, although we understand the market can be quite difficult.
Now, access to capital is always reliant on people being willing to invest. And that often requires stability in the regulatory environment. And banking, obviously, a highly regulated space. Are you happy that you have a framework in Namibia that allows you to be able to compete and build a successful banking platform?
So thank you so much for that. While it's highly regulated, I can confidently also say that the banking sector is doing quite well, and all thanks to our regulator where we have frameworks in place. I also believe that depending on how you as a bank can grow and able to show your return on investment to your shareholders, to your investors, I'm sure they are able to invest in your business. Currently, as we see, while there is a liquidity pressure perhaps in the market, I believe that the opportunities are there for investors to come and also fund the business and see what return, depending on the return on investment, those particular banks are able to give.
And lastly, if you could change something in either the laws or the regulatory environment that would really give you a place for a product or something that you've been wanting to do, what part of the environment would you change first?
So I won't say change. I will say compliment. I think there have been a lot of intervention, particularly from the regulatory space. I would love to say we have a very good relationship with our regulator, being Bank of Namibia. We have ongoing discussion, thought leadership. However, I think there is room for improvement, particularly from the digital strategy. I think the world is now going digital, and as a regulator, more and more engagement should happen, particularly from the digital regulations so that we can also serve our customers better from the comfort of the home. So digitalization is definitely key. We have seen the fintech now playing in the banking space. And as Benga, we need to be a step ahead of them. And the regulator will definitely play a role by assuring that we do have regulations that talk around digitalization.
I'm going to let you go now, but I did have one more question that I wanted to put to you, and it might be a difficult one. But we've seen the announcement of FEMA being delayed now for further consultation. Were you happy for further consultation to take place, or were you happy with FEMA in its current structure?
I believe there is always reason why regulation are coming on board. And I also believe that there is always a need to consult. I believe that there is a need to listen to the cry out there. And I'm happy that the regulator has put it on hold to have those consultations. So surely through the consultation, they will be able to pick up a few suggestions or advice that they can build in so that it can be acceptable by all. So in a nutshell, consultation is good. And I will also believe it was in the right spirit that FEMA was brought on board, but perhaps the consultation should happen.
Dr. Kali, thank you so much for appearing in our spotlight this evening. We wish you all the best in the role that you will play in helping to build a stronger and more resilient Namibian economy. That's Dr. Esther Kali, the CEO of Letekha Namibia, speaking to us in this evening's spotlight.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything.
Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova 103.5. As always, every week we take a little peek into our neighbors and what's going on around us, and certainly down in South Africa, an economy that we are totally intertwined with. And as always, we turn to our partners, biznews.com, who have their finger on the pulse of all things business, and Stuart Lohman joining us this evening. Stuart, another interesting week, as it always seems to be. And it feels like, as we watch from up here, that the strands are finally beginning to unravel around a lot of this state capture, but more specifically around a lot of the corruption in the Eskom ecosystem, which seems to have been, you know, almost internationally criminal in scale. There's a very interesting story on the site around two employees now that have been arrested in connection with allegedly inflated multi-million rand contracts at Kusile Power Station, which is obviously one of those projects that just never delivered and now seems to be almost fatally flawed from the start. Tell us a little bit about that story, because that's the kind of line that catches a lot of fish as it gets pulled in.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. It's always good to be here. Yeah, I suppose, as you say, it's that classic quote, slowly, slowly, then suddenly. And hopefully we're starting to enter the suddenly phase with state capture. It literally brought the country to its knees. So I suppose any small fish will hopefully lead to a bigger fish. You know, I suppose that's what everyone's looking at. We seen these smaller fish being arrested and taken in. But I think someone, or as the media, you're waiting for that big fish to be taken in. But the reason, obviously, Kusile, better known as the white elephant, doesn't really do what it was supposed to. But I suppose a lot of the contracts that were put in place are the reasoning behind that. And this one was with it's the ABB group, Asia Braun Bavari, and two people, former employees of that group have been arrested. obviously, again, inflating multi-million contracts for work at Kusile Power Station. And yeah, it's not the only two. I see there's another four as well. And hopefully the Hawks and Saps and SARS are sort of slowly sinking their teeth in. And yeah, we move from here.
And I mean, linked to the story, there was a former acting Eskom CEO, Machile Koko, who was accused of promising over 6 billion rand in future contracts. And that's, I mean, that's a very high profile fish to suddenly get caught up in this net as well. There's got to be a lot of big executives, either former or current at Eskom, who are sweating over these stories that are now coming out.
No, for sure. I know the social media is not something you go by, but a lot of the feedback was that Koko actually got found not guilty on this particular piece, but he's sort of been seen as one of the masterminds behind what happened at Eskom and all the contracts and stuff. But this one was linked to his stepdaughter, Koketso Choma. So, yeah, it's obviously a lot of conjecture there, Gary. And as you say, if someone of such stature were to be sort of taken down, I think there'd be a lot more optimism. But as you say, green shoots with that optimism in South Africa, and hopefully this bears many fruits for the citizens of this country. You had to endure what I'm sure we'll get into next is further load shedding, and this is one of the many reasons behind it, unfortunately.
Right, another huge story that exploded, and then we're still seeing some of the debris land as Steinhoff. And the resultant massive dishonesty and fraud that that seems to have been behind a lot of what drove that share price in the first place. But Steinhoff has been informed that Baffin has imposed an 11.3 million euro fine on Steinhoff for not reporting at financials in time. This seems like an extraordinary price to pay for a missed deadline. Is there more behind this?
Yeah, like I said, although we were having a discussion in the editorial this morning, and you look at 190 million rand if you convert it. And to us individuals, it's a lot, but it's not really a big sum to billion-dollar companies. But yeah, it seems excessive. There doesn't seem to be anything behind it. I thought what was interesting around this story, it's almost like Steinhoff just want to move forward, Gary. You know, you've got the CEO, Louis Dupree, says, we are pleased to have concluded another historically regulatory matter. You know, it's almost like they just want to let go of the past now and try to take this company forward, but the hooks just won't let them get on with it. There's always something else dragging them back.
It is amazing that you get smashed with 200 million bucks in fines. You're like, thank you. That's like the traffic cop only giving you $1,000 fine and you thank him for it on the way out. It's that's because he didn't last to look in your boot. So always something else going on there. There's another story coming out this week that we picked up on the site was City of Cape Town starting to put in place ways to buy powers from other manufacturers, and a linked story that said, if I understood it correctly, that buying from small-scale electricity producers could solve load shedding within a year. That seems like a big promise and something that's desperately needed.
Yeah, I've sort of referred to load shedding. I think it's not quite endemic, but it feels that way. Someone was saying to me, it's almost like a year ago, stage two was the norm, and now stage four is the norm. So heaven help us if stage six becomes a norm. And what you're seeing is a lot of, as you said, the City of Cape Town Solidarity Institute, a lot of institutions are trying to put forward fast-track ideas to sort of let us move beyond it. But the Cape Town mayor, Jordan Hill-Lewis, he's looking to just, what do you say, bash down doors and just get on with it, because while his proposal makes sense, it's not sort of legally granted sort of by government in a sense, but he just wants to get on with it and buy power from businesses and households and sort of prevent this level six issue that we hopefully don't get to, you know, with grass load shedding. And the Solidarity Institute just put a plan together, but they're looking at sort of ways that everyone becomes a supplier, you know, and do this mass project to sort of get people on stream. You see banks are financing a lot of household solar projects. So almost reverse the model in a sense, and where you sell electricity back in, because I mean, as you know, in Namibia, what we are granted in this on the southern tip is lots of sunshine. So let's use it and not endure these, as I say, cold, dark nights that most citizens are having to deal with. But yeah, it's quite nice to see the ingenuity and the drive from citizens around this.
So what's in his way? I mean, he's a mayor. He's got a big city. I'm assuming he's got decent budgets. He's got a whole lot of ratepayers who are contributing every month. Is he able to just start buying power from someone who's got, you know, 400 panels on their roof?
So legally, he's not. And that's that. I mean, if you listen to a lot of the interviews on BizNews this week, it's around political will. You know, there's a will from the citizens to move forward and find solutions, but there's even hamstrung by government, whether it be legal red tape, et cetera, et cetera. So he says he's going to go ahead with it and move forward, whereas national government might not see it that way. But like he says, what are they going to do? You know, we need to find solutions here. So I suppose there's a mismatch between the needs of the people and the sort of desires from national government to fix that. But that's not anything new, Gary. We can sit here all day and discuss how the sort of there's a misalignment in delivery from government and what citizens need. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. Political will is probably lacking from a national level. That's all that's in the way to sort of take away the red tape and move forward and take South Africa to where we all want it to be.
Certainly is it's an interesting play. Even from a DA perspective, there's been, you know, Al John Steenhuisen is enormously good at talking about things, and there's been a distinct amount of criticism against DA for just lack of action, despite them having a lot of areas that they can make action in. But it's also a brave call from a mayor to take on federal law, which is effectively what he'd be doing. And it's an interesting gunfight, the OK Corral, because were government to try and stop him, they'd have to defend, giving consumers what they need and giving industry what it needs in court. And if they were to lose that, that would open the gateway for, you know, almost a mass exodus from reliance on the power grid and mass investment in doing what Eskom can't, and would further entrench the woes of Eskom. So, I mean, I think politically it's an interesting move, but it also puts the government in a position very kind of almost untenable, where they've either got to defend the current practice or they've got to allow it to change, and neither one is good for them.
Yeah, there's also murmurs that Cyril wants to talk. Sorry, President Ramaphosa, and sort of mentions sort of on the street energy emergencies and things like that. And I think that would open the door to what Mayor Hill Lewis is doing, you know, and it would sort of clear all that red tape. But we'll still wait and see what happens there. But so there could be a lot of movement in it. I think it is almost some would argue it's probably a bigger threat than COVID placed, you know, this sort of energy threat. And the problem is the solutions are there. And that's, I think, what you're seeing now. People are presenting solutions. So let's move forward. You know, you don't be seen to be inept. We might question it, but if you can, you know, you can always change the direction of the ship if you move, you know, bit by bit. So let's see what comes out of the governing party. You know, Cyril might have something up his sleeve. He might mention something in the next coming days. But, yeah, it's nice to see on the ground people trying to put citizens first.
In many ways, it reminds us of the old adage that necessity is the mother of invention, and that when you need to, you have to. So we'll watch the space, and Stuart, we'll catch up with you again next week and find out what else has happened down in the wild south. Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed. That's Stuart Lohman from biznews.com. You can go read about these stories and many, many others, including some fascinating video and interviews as well with some of the most interesting people. That's on biznews.com. That's it for this week's BizNews Weekly Wrap.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at MNZ Motors.
Gary Strubel on The Business Report.
Welcome back to The Business Report here on Nova 103.5. And time now for our Market Watch. And our Market Watch this evening is around the market of fuel and energy. Now, Henny Kruger, the chairperson of the Fuel and Franchise Association of Namibia, has expressed his dissatisfaction with the government's involvement in fuel retail through the National Petroleum Corporation of Namibia. At a meeting that was attended by over 100 value chain participants to address industry concerns, Kruger singled out low profit margins for fuel retailers and service stations specifically, which he said have seen their profits dwindle. Kruger said Namcor gets substantial subsidies from the government and gets a substantial amount of the markup, adding that the government gets a cut of the petrol price and gets money from taxes, while fuel retailers have seen their profits decline to below 5% gross profit. Henny Kruger, the chairperson of the Fuel and Franchise Association of Namibia, is our guest this evening. Henny, welcome to the Business Report.
Hello, Gary. Thank you very much.
So, take us through the situation at the moment. Obviously, we've seen dramatic fuel prices, fuel price increases over the last couple of months that have really hurt consumers in a big way. But we often forget that things are always changing as well for the retailers themselves. And from the report that we started out with, it's clear that retailers are starting to feel that government might be crowding them out a little bit. Tell us a little bit about the position that you have at the moment.
Yes, Gary, I think we should start a little way back, 3, 5, even 8 years ago. There's a number of issues that had been raised with government over time, and those issues were directly affecting retailers, retailer business in general, and then, of course, the profit margins and the sustainability of retailers. So there were a number of communications between the retail organizations, and there are three, at least, in the country, representing some of them smaller and others larger. We are one of the larger associations, or the largest and the oldest. So basically what happened is that there was always this concern from retailers, and let me just put one misconception into perspective. The consumer often thinks mistakenly that when the price goes up, the retailer makes more money, and nothing can be further from the truth than that. Retailers get a fixed cent per liter retail margin. That retail margin is determined by government, of course, because it's a regulated industry. So retailers have no control over what their profits are, where they may do business, with whom they may do business, and how they should do business, and at what standards they should do. It's all regulated. So it's legislated, and government controls as the regulator and custodian of the act. So the basic thing is that we had been communicating with government and said, listen, there's a number of issues that is becoming more and more irritating. Is that the right way?
Yeah.
A little bit concerns and challenges. And what happened in the end is that one of those big issues were the banks. The banks and the bank card commissions and the cash collection commissions. We receive $1.13. Banks take a commission of between 1.85%. That's minimum of the card swiping fee on a debit or credit card. So that's a collection commission or a swiping fee. They obviously charge the consumer also a percentage, but the essence is that as the price goes up, the percentage of 1.85% grows in cents per liter. So as we stand today on a fuel price of $22.77 for diesel, if you fill up your tank, 42 cents per liter goes to the bank directly from the retailer's account. Now, if a retailer only receives $1.13 minus 42 cents per liter, he still has to pay all his overheads just from that remainder of the money. So that was one issue. The other side of the banking issue was that banks, obviously, if money doesn't go through a card and a swipe fee, it obviously becomes cash.
Sure.
That cash must be banked, CIT fees, assets in transit vehicles come and collect the money, taken to the bank, and the bank again charges a 3-5% collection, cash collection commission. Now, with a margin at the moment of 4.97%, below 5% GP, gross profit, not net profit, gross profit. And the bank takes 5% cash collection commission, there's nothing left. The dealer is paying in just to deliver the money into the bank. And we've been involved in ongoing discussions with not only Bank of Namibia, but PAN, our ministry, Line Ministry, the regulator of Mines and Energy. And we had been, I wouldn't say forewarning them, but said this is going to become a crisis.
Can I interrupt you for a second? How did we get here? You're saying that the cents per liter is fixed. So it's not a fixed percentage of the price. It's a fixed cents per liter. Has the government not been adjusting that cents per liter upwards in line with fuel increases?
for the past four years, it hasn't been done. In the past, 4 years ago, up until 4 years ago, we had an annual survey being conducted whereby the Northwest University independently would evaluate the main cost drivers and evaluate it in relation to the retail margin. And then the retail margin would have been adjusted on a predetermined methodology, which was agreed between retailers and the ministry and, of course, the survey consultants. Now, for reasons known only to the government, they stopped that survey. So it turned out that government thought to an extent that CPI would be a valid increase for the retail margin, which they only have done until last year. And this year, there was no CPI adjustment, even despite the agreement that there was with government to annually in January adjust the fuel retail margin by the CPI percentage.
Worth mentioning, the price of fuel has gone up by over 100% in that four-year period.
Exactly. So that presses on your cash flow. That creates the you know, in March 2020, you needed 426,000 to buy a full load, 42,000 liters of fuel. Today, you need 965,000. And you have to pay it in advance. If you don't pay in advance 72 hours, you fall again back into the queue, you wait another 72 hours, you run dry. Now, racing, I don't know how many consumers is out there that can race extra 500,000. How many businesses there are after what we went through in COVID and the recession and the drought and whatever, that can immediately, just by a Wednesday receiving a notice, get an extra 100 or 160,000 to buy the next day stock.
Sure.
And that is one of the pressing issues that caused the retailers to become more and more uncomfortable.
Okay, so let's touch on another issue that we mentioned in our preamble, and this is obviously the fact that private enterprise is to some extent competing with government as well directly in the fuel space through NAMCOR. How much pressure does that add to the burden, given that we assume that there's quite a heavy amount of subsidy that goes into that?
Gary, I must be honest with you. Some of the news agencies that attended the conference, I didn't know they were going to be there. I thought it was a private meeting, but obviously it was a meeting between different associations, and some of the associations thought that it would be necessary for the media to be there. And I mean, we're not against it, but I only realized afterwards that there was news agencies. And then I must sadly say so that some of the news agencies trying to make a lot from the NAMCOR issue.
Okay.
It's not NAMCOR. NAMCOR can compete. NAMCOR can do business. Yes, there are questions that arises, and I'll tell you why it arises. Because government is the 100% owner of NAMCOR. So there's this concern with not only retailers, I think consumers also have this thought of, you're seeing this magnificent service station arising just across a fully functional operative service station in a rural area. And you can't understand where does the money come from to build such an extravagant, beautiful place, and how it's going to be recovered. It's a topic for a different day. But it's not about NAMCOR. What we are concerned is that government had been warned in the past 4 to 5 years, national volumes are declining. Business is getting more and more difficult. Government stopped S&T traveling. You will recall, and I think the consumers will all recall, that at a certain stage, 5, 6 years ago, you would see a lot of government cars on the roads. Today, if you see one, it's a strange sighting.
It's a cop with his lights on.
Yes. So that being said, our concern from retail side is just this. Government, and we requested a moratorium to be placed on the issue of new licenses. In a declining market, the declining volumes, it just makes sense that government put more precautions in to not open competition when it doesn't justify it financially. And after the moratorium, like in really immediately after the moratorium was uplifted by government, once again, without communication to us, but it was just uplifted. Not that I say they must ask us permission for everything, but, you know, that is principles of administrative business on government. It's auri alterum. Hear the other side, give them notice, whatever. But we realized the moratorium was uplifted, and suddenly you saw everywhere NAMCOR sites being built. And they've been licensed by government. And we keep on asking the question, is this sustainable? Is this feasible? How was these licenses authorized, and why in all these small towns where there's already limited volumes available and the existing service stations are already suffering? So it didn't make sense to us. It's not only Namcor, there's other brands who are also competing with themselves. You will drive in some towns and you will see that there are three service stations of one brand in one street. It's ridiculous. Mm. Why? And we keep on saying from the association side and advising, why doesn't government just force the upgrade of existing sites, existing licenses? There's enough. And they can do it easily. They can make it better. They can install more islands. They can empower those individuals who are already issued with licenses to become stronger. And if there's a volume growth, which there's not.
Yeah.
So that is the issue. It's not necessarily Namcor.
Okay. There's a bundle of issues.
There's a bundle of issues, but the thing is, why issuing new licenses if the volumes and the industry are under pressure?
Okay, so the licensing issue is obviously a mid to long term issue that either will or won't resolve itself, and there are many industries in which this is an issue, ours included, by the way. However, given the situation that retailers find themselves in now, and the situation consumers find themselves in now, especially over the last 2 or 3 months, where prices have skyrocketed, and we assume volumes are going to shrink even further off the back of that. What could be done in the short term? What are you asking for in the short term? Is the rational solution?
The perception of what we get from government and specifically from the regulator is that the regulator wants to protect the consumer at the cost of the retailer. Now, creating that competition is
it's not a dichotomy, it's a synergy.
As far as it concerns us, it's unfair. If all service stations or most service stations in the rural areas goes bankrupt tomorrow, who's going to supply fuel? Who's going to supply other services, airtime, bread, milk, etc.? There's a wide variety of services that a service station offers. But on the other hand, we say government, BFP fuel landed at the coast is run about between $7 and $11. Whatever is added after that is taxes and funds fees, and we're not saying that they should not be funded, and we're not saying government should not charge taxes.
Yep.
But we are saying, why playing two critical parts of the fuel makeup off against each other, the consumer and the fuel retailer, and saying to will you say to the retailer or the consumer, listen, the retailers are now forcing us to increase the price. You can lower taxes. We're not here to tell government how they should do it. There's many options they have to do.
If you were in charge now, what would you do?
I'm glad I'm not.
Short term. what is the most, what's the lowest hanging fruit that government can look at if someone's listening out there tonight and says, hang on, this could be a real problem?
One of the main things that came up at the conference that we held last week, Wednesday, was that we don't have funds. The retailers doesn't really have funds. We are living, we've really bonded whatever we have, and overdrafts was extended to the maximum. But you hear about certain funds being funded in the makeup of the price that has investments of billions lying in other funds. I think there should be a proper survey to, first of all, secure the sustainability and profitability of wholesalers and retailers. I'm not saying the one must be enjoy preferent treatment above the other. So all the individuals who are distributing and selling and storing fuel, they must be obviously sustainable and profitable. And then, of course, there are funds who have resources where they can dip back into. If they are, and if it's true, and if it's correct, that our interpretation of those funds, they should start living on those funds because we don't have any other funds. And government should start looking and return back to the model they are using to make up the fuel price. There they can, government can assist the consumer. Of course, there's other funds we believe where government can raise money. The problem is where we find ourselves now in terms of not saving through the fat years. I understand government is in trouble. But that can't be our problem.
Times are tough everywhere. Yeah. William Ahini, I'm afraid that's what we've got time for this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Henny Kruger, the chairperson of the Fuel and Franchise Association of Namibia, that reports that many retailers are seeing their profits decline as little as 5% gross profit. And, of course, this would be of concern to people all over the country. So perhaps just get an extra couple of liters of milk at the shop while you're filling up that tank. Real concerns, real issues. And that's our Market Watch this evening, right here on the Business Report.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na.
With lots in the news this week about fuel retailers threatening strikes and demands for an increase in the margin, we are speaking to Maggie Shino, the Petroleum Commissioner in the Ministry of Mines and Energy, to find out more. Good day, Mrs. Shino.
Good day, Mr. Shevet. Good day, listeners.
To start us off, maybe, can you explain to us what exactly are the demands of the association?
The ministry has been in consultation and engagement with the association for the past few weeks. It boils down to a few issues, basically, because we are operating in a very highly regulated industry. The association have given us concern over issues that makes it difficult for them to operate. These issues have ranging basically from the main issue is that they have concern over the margin increase. There hasn't been an increment in their margin as it should have been. And they have also raised concern in terms of operations in the industry, concerns with their relationship with the wholesalers or the major or the importers of the product. And they have raised also concern with regards to the bank in terms of the fees and the charges that they are being imposed on them when dealing with this industry. Plus then also concern over that Namibia seems to have quite a number, a large number of fuel stations that are emerging, creating a very strict competitive working environment in a highly regulated industry. And that also then put pressure on their revenue as dealers.
Okay, speaking of those new fuel stations, is the fact that some of them are NAMCO stations a sticking point with them?
Not necessarily that the new service stations are NAMCO service station. That is what is the concern. The concern is just in overall that the number of service stations are on the increase and the share in the volumes or the volumes that are being consumed in Namibia are not growing too much with the number of service stations that are coming. And they also requested for understanding in terms of NAMCO, the participation, because their understanding was that NAMCO was operating both in the retail and also the wholesale. And clarity was just provided that NAMCO is just a wholesaler like all other wholesalers who are importers. And when they invest in infrastructures of service station, the operators are private individuals who have the rights to franchise right from NAMCO to participate and be dealers. It's not as if that the national oil company is operating from both fronts.
Okay. In terms of the threatened strike action, what's the ministry's position on that matter?
We have called for further engagement, and at this position, the negotiation are still continuing. It's an unfortunate situation that we find ourselves in. It's a matter of just the wrong timing because of the current market conditions. So we are encouraging continuing the negotiation or the engagement with them so that we can be able to find a common ground in terms of a solution for the industry to be able to go forward. So, and at this stage, we have also set another meeting for us to sit again around the table, which is scheduled for early next week. And through that meeting, we'll then be able to iron out a number of issues that can be able to provide us a common solution or common goal towards the demands and from both sides.
Okay. In terms of the meeting that you held this week, we understand that it was sort of explained and accepted by the association that the current market just isn't conducive for a margin increase at the moment, but that when it does become conducive, that can be explored. What were some of the other sort of highlights or key takeaways from this week's meeting?
That was the main issue that the ministry definitely agree with their position, and that we will be able to. However, they should be informed that it's just a matter of timing. We will continue to watch the market, and as soon as a window of opportunity where we see that the prices are stabilizing and we have an over recovery being recorded from the fuel price review, we'll be able then to reconsider the position and be able to see how best we can then accommodate the demand going forward.
All right. Finally, there was obviously a lot of concern from the general public when there was talk about possible strike action. I know, as you say, things have been called off and negotiations are ongoing. But does government have a plan if such action were to be taken?
At this stage, the government seek for more understanding. We understand their plight. We understand where they are coming from. And we see that the pressure that the market condition has put on their operation is indeed real. But we seek their understanding to such an effect that a strike will only worsen the situation for all. It worsen the situation for the general public, it worsen the situation for the industry, and it worsen the situation for the Namibian government as a whole. And for us, therefore, we just ask for understanding, for us to just tighten our belt a little bit more, so that we can be able, the ministry can be able then to take into consideration their request without necessarily putting on the unnecessary pressure on the Namibian consumers. So it's a matter of timing. And as soon as the market condition improve, we will be able to reconsider.
Thank you so much, Mrs. Shino, and we'll definitely carry on watching this story going forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
And welcome back to The Business Report on Nova 1035. Now, the Tour and Safari Association of Namibia officially launched their online visa application platform in the capital today. The private sector initiative has been developed by the Tour and Safari Association of Namibia and strives to streamline the process of the different types of visa and permit applications that are handled by the TASA for processing with the Ministry of Home Affairs on behalf of the applicant. Natalie Arends, the chairperson of TASA, is our guest this evening. Natalie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What is the main objective with an online visa application process?
So, yeah, I mean, we've all been involved with Home Affairs and all the paperwork that is required for anything that involves any form of document that you require from Home Affairs. So this is basically to streamline the process and make it easier for our office manager, but obviously also for our members or for anybody that applies for visas. So you can, when you access the portal, it also shows you exactly which documents you need, and you can get everything ready and then apply and upload everything in one go. Previously, it was all by email, back and forth, and telephone calls of what was required and so forth. So it was very, very work intensive. While all of it can now be uploaded to the platform, then our office manager gets an email that says the new application has been received. She can just print it, and then we can go off to Home Affairs to get it done.
You know, it's I would imagine, primarily aimed at tourists and solving some of their short-term stays. But we know that many corporates in Namibia and other businesses bring people in from time to time, whether it be for training or for projects. Is the platform able to assist in those spaces as well?
Absolutely. It is basically we work with any kind of, we do work visas, employment permits and work permits, temporary and residence permits, holiday and tourist visas, as well as extensions and renewals. And while we do work mostly with tourism applications, it's exactly the same process for anybody. So, yes, we do facilitate anybody that requires a visa. We are not exclusive to tourism. And we obviously, when you say short-term, You mean the short-term stay of the person, but I would also like to mention at this point that we do require approximately that these visas are submitted about a month in advance, because sometimes Home Affairs takes longer and there's back and forth if they need additional information. Sometimes they require additional information on top of the normal application, especially when it comes to work permits. They need additional motivation and things like that, and obviously work permits take longer in any case, but even for visas, to give us enough time to process, because we can obviously not take responsibility if there are delays at Home Affairs itself.
Okay, so just from a portal perspective, this perhaps just important to clarify, and I'll phrase it as a statement and let me know if I'm wrong. The online application is your platform, and my applications are basically a way to digitize my applications into you guys. This isn't plugged directly into Home Affairs, and people think if they're going through a portal, they're somehow dealing directly with Home Affairs.
No, unfortunately not. This might be something for the future, but at this stage not. We are working on getting a dedicated person at Home Affairs who we can just plainly email all this documentation to, because they work with copies for everything anyway, so we might as well just email it. And we have built up really good contacts at Home Affairs, and they've been very supportive of TAZA, and they really work very well with us. So this is definitely something we are working on for the future, but it's not something that is directly plugged into their system now.
So just an interesting question you've mentioned at the moment, directly supportive of TAZA, and I think that, you know, the recovery of the Namibian tourism sector is something that is close to many, many businesses and institutions' hearts. However, you also mentioned that you're dealing with work permits and other forms of visas, and that might start treading on other toes outside of the tourism sector. And my question, I suppose, is a complicated one, but how much of that support is because the initial application would be primarily for tourist purposes? And what potential is there for disruption the moment it starts becoming, you know, a much wider service?
You know, work permits, I know there are a lot of people that fiercely against work permits because it encroaches on Namibian employment. However, in quite a few areas, we just simply don't have enough expertise. And I do believe that in those cases, permits are obviously something that is required. Now, especially for work permits, one needs to support your documentation by showing that you have advertised locally, that you have not been able to get any candidates that were able to have all the ticks for what is required for the job and why not. And only once you have completed all of that documentation will Home Affairs even consider such an application. From where I personally work at the moment, for my company, they even recently sent out someone from Home Affairs to do an audit with us on an application that we received, just to make sure that it is a legitimate application, which I think goes far beyond what one would expect Home Affairs to really do, to double check that things are above board. And I really commend them for that. So yes, I do think that the permits that we deal with, mostly obviously for tourism-related stuff, are above board and for things that are really required. For example, executive chefs and things like that are a little bit short in the country at this stage. We've had a tremendous loss of tourism staff over COVID. We went into other industries of the last 2 years. So there is genuinely a real shortage of qualified people and experienced people that want to work in tourism because they feel they've burned their fingers. So in those cases, one needs to obviously apply for permits because the job needs to be done. But I don't think anybody will voluntarily go through the entire permit process and application and rigmarole if they can find a suitably qualified person in Namibia.
All right. And then just lastly, we're nearly out of time, but perhaps just give us an idea on the costs of using the platform, and is it open for the general public to use, or is it only for members of TAZA?
It's open to anybody. Anybody can use it. The costs are basically exactly the same whether you apply directly with TAZA or online. It is we give a very small discount to TAZA members on our only on our service fee. So that works to about $50-60 million difference between members and non-members. But the actual fees really depend entirely on what Home Affairs charges. So, for example, for a tourist visa, we're looking at about $1,600 Namibian dollars. But that includes our service fee and the fee from Home Affairs, which is by far the bigger chunk of that cost. And obviously, work permits and things are far more expensive than that. I don't have all the fees off my cuff at the moment. But yeah, we basically charge the same service fee for all the applications, because exactly the same work is included, but then obviously the cost at Home Affairs is added.
Okay, and then just lastly, where can people find the portal? How do they go about engaging? Do you have the web address, or can they do a Google search of some sort?
Okay, so the TASA website is very easy. It's www.tasa.na. So that's very, very easy. And then the portal link is directly on the homepage. Members can also apply for TASA membership there. And there's another link under the membership applications. But yeah, so you can access it from both those, but both are on the homepage of the TASA webpage, TASA.na.
Natalie Ahrens, thank you so much for taking part in the show this day, and good luck with what hopefully will really streamline that process and assist the tourism industry with its ongoing recovery. That is Natalie Ahrens from TASA, the Tour and Safari Association of Namibia, who have officially launched their online visa application platform, and you can find that at TASA.na.
It's the Business Report with Gary Strubel. The Business Report, Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. Cabinet has approved the extension of import age restrictions for non-commercial vehicles up to 12 years from the current age limit cap of 8 years, effective for a period of 2 years. Minister of Labour, Industrial Relations and Employment Creation, Utoni Nyoma, has raised a concern regarding a continuous contravention of the relevant provisions of the Labour Act 2007 and the Collective Agreement for Minimum Wages in the Security Industry, after 61 of the 182 employers inspected were found to be non-compliant. The National Petroleum Company of Namibia says calls by the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Natural Resources to increase its equity in oil exploration activities to over 50% from the current 10% are ill-advised and will have disastrous consequences for the emerging sector. Meanwhile, following discussions with the ministry about their concerns, including the fact that the dealer margin has remained constant for the past 4 years and calls to restrict fuel wholesalers and banks from operating in the retail market, the much-talked-about nationwide service station shutdown has been called off for now. Members of the Namibia Transport and Taxi Union are, though, planning to strike in Windhoek on the 26th of July. Unionists are demanding a 40% fare increase, saying taxi prices have not been adjusted for at least 2 years, despite rising fuel prices, maintenance costs, and other expenses. Oshana Governor Elia Irimari said the provision of affordable housing remains a challenge in the region. Agribank is still seeking buyers for its Witvlei abattoir located in the Omaheke region, while the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform announced that they will soon build a meat processing plant worth $35 million in Katima Malilo. And Vice President of the Namibia University of Science and Technology, Dr. Errol Naumab, says there is a need to include low-income communities and underserved groups in the development of novel products and services, including, in among other things, food and agro-processing, mining and value addition, digital and global business services, and green hydrogen. South African power utility Eskom's chief executive officer, Andre de Reiter, says it will take several weeks for the power utility to fully recover from the recent strike action. Tanzania Petroleum Development Corporation has revealed that it will finalize the construction of 5 more compressed natural gas filling stations by March 2023 in a bid to increase LNG usage in the country. And finally, in what is being called the least surprising news of the decade, Elon Musk says he's backing out of his bid to buy social media platform Twitter. But Simon Marks reports Twitter's board is indicating that it will take legal action against him if he does.
Elon Musk, suspected by many analysts of never really planning to buy Twitter in the first place, now says he won't buy Twitter. Twitter's board, which never really wanted to sell it to him in the first place, now says it's going to hold him to his $44 billion offer and, if necessary, pursue him in the courts. The only certainty, it'll be the lawyers who make out like bandits.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. If you only heard bits of something or you want to hear a little bit more, you can go along to our website. That's nova.com.na. And there's a podcast tab that you can go find the Business Report there. And this episode, as well as all of our previous episodes, you can go check them out there. You can also get hold of us on email. That's TBR, the Business Report, TBR at nova.com.na. Pop us an email. Let us know what you think, if you disagree, and if there's something you think we should be covering, you can get hold of us. You can also get hold of us on Twitter, the Business Report there. And, of course, as always, you can give us a ring here in the studio. You can send us doves, and we're highly bribable as well. We'll take steak sandwiches on a Friday afternoon anytime. That's it for this evening's show. Our thanks, as always, to our producer, Angie Schultz, Raymond Ziefeld, our technical producer, David Bishop, for all his contributions into the show as well. To all of our guests, thanks for making their time. And to you, the listener, thank you so much for making it all so worthwhile. That's it for this week. We'll catch you again next week as we try and bring you all the best in Namibia's business environment.
That was the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Strubble and produced by Angie Schultz and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.